Hello, sunken places and special agents sent here to ruin my evening and possibly my entire life and all the ships at sea, and welcome to A Very Good Year, the movie podcast where we invite a guest to pick their favorite year of movies and talk to us about that year. I'm your host, Jason Bailey, and across the mic and across the country from me is my co-host,
Michael Hull.
Our guest today is one of the excellent TV critics at Variety, where she writes reviews, columns, and features for the magazine. Before that, she was the founding TV critic at The Ringer. And before that, friends, we worked together at the late lamented Flavor Wire. Gang, please welcome my friend and yours, the funny, the insightful Allison Herman. Hey, Allison.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you so much for being here. It's so good to see you. I haven't seen you, your face talking to me since you abandoned us here in New York for a place where I understand the weather is always nice and there's always something enjoyable to do, but it's fine. I'm not bitter. How are you enjoying life in California?
I am enjoying it greatly, although I need to correct you in that we have had several recent storms, and I know everyone mocks LA for being disrupted by the rain, but I feel the need to explain to people that it's because the infrastructure here is not built to withstand it. So it means that if we have 2 inches of rain, there will be flooding, there will be accidents on the road, etc. So I just need to stick up for my fellow Californians on that front.
Sure. Here's the thing. I don't know when the last time was you were in New York, but these days we get 2 inches of rain and all the roads are flooded and the subways are inoperable. And so it's not really that big of a difference anymore. One of our first guests, Allison, was Vulture's TV critic, Roxana Haddadi. And I think of the two of you in much the same way, because I see both of you as film people who the TV people stole. I see you both like Carol Ann in Poltergeist. The TV people came and took you away. So congrats on the success you've had writing about this far inferior medium. But it's so nice to have you on to talk about movies, because you are a film lover as well. Yes.
I am, and I do feel the need again to stick up for a maligned cultural object and say, I also came into TV criticism at a time when movies and TV started collapsing into one another, and that process
definitely
has yet to cease. I will be reviewing a television series next month starring Annette Bening, a sentence I cannot believe I'm saying out loud, and that's not even like a notable thing. It's on Peacock, so, you know, we are the only three people who will ever know about it.
Right. I kid the TV. There was a time at this point, sticking up for TV is kind of like sticking up for superhero movies, because it's like, you know what? TV kind of won. I mean, like, in terms of what people are actually talking about, like, that are not people in my immediate circle, like, TV really kind of won like a few years ago, or at least that's the feeling I get. Do you get that same feeling?
I think it sort of depends on the time of year. And also the thing is, like, maybe TV as a whole won, but TV itself is so oversaturated that, like, I also experience the feeling of being like, I love this thing. Why isn't anyone else talking about this? And as opposed to being an entire medium, it's some like deep cut niche, you know, animated show that never got publicity from HBO Max, to cite a recent example. Everyone watched Scavenger's Rain. It's wonderful.
Never, no idea what you're talking about. Never heard those two words together as a title. Not a clue. It is a lot. There is a lot of stuff. And I guess maybe that is a question I have, not to get too inside baseball critic to critic. Like, I feel like I can't keep up with the new movies. And that's like a small percentage of how much new stuff there is to see as a TV critic. How do you keep up with what you feel like you have to have seen, not only for work, but just sort of like to do the job well?
On a very practical level, I keep a spreadsheet, which is something I started doing a few years ago and like cannot believe I ever didn't do. It's great to just have a visual log of like, what episode did I leave off of on that show that I haven't, you know, been checking in on week to week or what have you? And does like in my, you know, it like weirdly motivates you because you get an extra line to enter on the sheet. And then another thing is, I'm very blessed at Variety to have a co-critic, Aramide Tinubu. And it means that, you know, as a trade, Variety likes to think of itself as the paper of record of Hollywood. And they genuinely feel that it is important to dedicate human resources to covering the full breadth of television. And thankfully, that does alleviate some things. But then the broader philosophical answer to that is you just have to accept, like, you will never watch all of television. No one can watch all of television. And all you can really do is try your level best, check in on the things that are noteworthy, and just accept that you're going to miss them some things. Like, I was kicking myself the other week because I finally circled back and watched a show on Apple called Drops of God. That is a French It is a French Japanese manga adaptation they decided to release in the end of the in the middle of the final season of Succession. Super great strategy on Tim Cook's part. and I just, you know, didn't get around to it and was watching it and was like, if I'd watched this when it came out, I think it certainly would have made at least one of the, you know, best of the year so far, best of the year lists, because it's fantastic. But some things just kind of get lost in the sauce, and I just have to understand that and do my level best.
I understand entirely. Well, kudos, because you are doing very well. It has been, and I mean this sincerely, a real pleasure to watch your career like ascend as someone who knew you when you were just like starting out. And it's richly deserved. You're real fucking good at what you do. What year then? Let's switch to movies now. Let's get back in your movie head. What year did you choose to talk about us to talk about with us tonight, and why?
I chose 2017. On a macro level, I do think it's probably the best recent single year in movies prior to the one that we just all went through, which was remarkable by any standard. And then on a personal note, 2017 was my first full year living in LA, a town that you might guess has a very singular relationship to movies and the act of movie going. And, you know, I was new to LA. I didn't know anyone. And my office at the time was two blocks away from the dearly departed Arclight Hollywood Cinerama Dome. Which meant,
so you logged a few hours there over that year. Then.
Yeah, it was like every single time I just like didn't know what I wanted to do with my life, I would just walk over and be like, what's playing? So I saw an extraordinary number of movies that year, but I also got to experience, you know, there's like a very special feeling when a big movie comes out in L.A. And one of the movies on my list I went to see at the Arclight Hollywood, and they handed out a physical program. Which is apparently a thing that would happen basically only at that theater, only when like a certain small handful of auteur name brand directors would release something new. And it feels like going to church. Like you would just show up and you knew everyone was there.
Yeah.
To take it really, really seriously. At one point, you know, not in 2017, but I saw Once Upon a Time in Hollywood at the Arclight, and my friend was stuck in traffic, showed up 15 minutes late, and was not allowed to enter the theater. They were like, here is a voucher. You are too late, and you will be disturbing the other audience members. You cannot enter the screening any longer. So it's obviously like a little pretentious, but I, as you said, logged many hours there, and I have a very fond
memory. I only support
memory.
Fascism in one place, and it's the entry to the movie theater. Only movie theater ushers get to be fascists. Nobody else.
And indeed, they were.
Okay, so this is the most recent year we've ever done, which is cool. Like to hold a year that's not that long aloft as already being kind of one of the greats. What do you think was, as someone who was experiencing it, as you say, in the center of the industry, what was in the air, in the water, in the atmosphere in 2017 that gave us this sort of bumper crop of good stuff?
I mean, I can't quite say in the behind the scenes industry title forces, but I think looking at the list of movies that came out this year, one of the things that stood out to me is what a range there is. Like on the low end, there are, or not on the low end, but on the smaller end, there are lots of audacious independent movies. There are a lot of feel-good success stories of smaller independent movies that broke out to become the mainstream, which is, you know, now more than ever this like fairy tale unicorn moment. Right. But at the same time, like, we're in this blockbuster IP era, and I think sometimes it's easy to be fatalist about that entire genre of entertainment, not for no reason, but one of the things that stood out when I was looking at releases this year is there were lots of franchise films with nine-figure budgets that don't need a qualifier to just be a good movie. And I think sometimes that can be a reminder to hold certain things to a higher standard, because it doesn't just have to be like good for the fourth Minions movie or whatever. It can be just a good movie, and that is the expectation you should have going into a movie theater. And so the fact that this year encompasses everything from Get Out, which had a like sub $10 million budget, I think it was like five, right, to, you know, a Star Wars movie. And there was real quality at every level on that spectrum. And then in the middle, you had your Sofia Coppola movies, your whatever. Annapurna was still flushing money down the toilet like nobody's business. So you got a lot of those. But yeah, it's just it ended up being a lot to enjoy for every audience at every price point, which I really appreciate, because that's not always the case now.
Amen. Well said. All right. Well, we're going to get into that nice wide spread of types of movies that made your top five. But before we do, Mike is going to walk us through some of what was happening in the world outside of the Arclight Theater. Here's headlines.
2017 started off on some bullshit with Donald Trump being inaugurated as president of the United States.
Christ. Okay.
In front of a few dozen friends and supporters.
little tiny turnout, just a little shitty turnout.
U.S. Parks officials prepared for attendance numbers similar to those enjoyed by Obama, but found themselves overstaffed and overprepared for the lackluster showing. Yeah. Overchaired? Is that a thing? Yeah. Overhaired?
Yeah.
Remember when he looked at the eclipse?
Oh, God.
2017 was also the year of Covfefe.
Oh, God.
Remember Anthony Scaramucci?
This is like a fever dream, Mike. I don't want to go back to this. Is there other news?
To make Trump jokes, dude. He's not funny.
I believe Alec Baldwin's brilliant SNL sketches would beg to differ, Michael Hall.
Fair enough. He and I'll just have to agree to disagree. 2017 marked the official start of the Me Too movement. This was also the year of the Pink Hat Ladies and the Women's March, the largest protest in U.S. history, which they held in D.C. the day after his inauguration.
Mm-hmm.
Right. The ladies had a much big... Are we going to make a mall penis comparison? Are we going to make a big dick?
Go.
No?
Yeah, all right,
we're going to move
fine.
On. Good it's show, right. ladies. Robert Mueller was wasting everybody's time going on about some emails, and the internet was abuzz with stories about a grand pedophilia grotto under a pizza joint in D.C. It was all deeply, offensively stupid. I know you remember. It was very recent.
I'm trying to forget. I'm trying badly to forget.
2017 was the year of the big shooting in Las Vegas.
Oh, God.
Fuck, this is terrible. I don't even know if I can keep reading. No more of that paragraph. August was the Unite the Right rally in Charlotte.
God damn it. Michael Hull, Jesus Christ.
Ugh. But, you know, 2017 was also the year that a bunch of the art those Tiki Torch guys like got taken the fuck down.
That's
so
true.
A bunch of them went to jail, and they lost a lot of their stupid statues. So,
yeah. All right.
You know, with the moral arc of the universe thing. Here's the
silver
thing.
Silver lining. Okay.
2017 felt like shit in a lot of really acute ways, because our media loves to watch terrible people burn, and plenty of terrible people were burning. But also in 2017, there were big, major, massive studies that showed that the world was experiencing significantly less famine, significantly fewer war deaths, significantly fewer deaths from natural disasters, progress against pestilence. All of this shit is infrastructure things, right? Is like, you know, we're talking about the 2 inches of rain, and that's definitely a problem in Los Angeles. But until, you know, people stopped taking their kids to get measles vaccines, people were protected from things, right? There's infrastructure things that were happening, and they are working. There was a greater life expectancy around the globe, more democracy in general, not necessarily in Washington, D.C. in 2017, but globally, there were expanding rights for women and sexual minorities, fewer people living on $2 a day, more green energy, et cetera, et cetera. There's actually a really lovely article in Vox that lists a bunch of things that run counter to your intuitive impression of 2017, and they're pretty good, and we'll put that in the show notes. So okay. Big picture, we're doing good.
Okay.
All right? Everybody's showing up. Everybody's doing the right things. They're just not getting attention for it. Does any of this sound familiar? No, we're not talking about movies. This is the news segment. That's headlines. Good job, everybody.
Thank you, Mike. All right, Allison Herman, you ready to do a top five?
Yes, although now I need to note that now that you've listed all those things, I'm wondering if maybe 2017 was just a good movie year because we all psychologically needed an escape. And so we just, whatever we saw, we thought was great. So now I'm reconsidering some choices, but that may have played into my memory of my movie going year.
You know what? They really loved the moving pictures during the Great Depression. We have talked about that before. All right. Allison, we decided we're going to do a chronological top five. We're going to go through these as they hit through the year, which I think is really good because this first one, especially, I have a very clear memory of when it came out. So what is the chronologically the first film in your top five of 2017?
Yeah, chronologically by a matter of 6 months. This is very, very early in the year was Get Out.
We're here. Are you ready for this?
I'm begging to be.
Call me Dean and you're hungry, my man.
We're thrilled to have you up for the get-together.
I want to introduce Rose's boyfriend.
I'm Chris. Couldn't see no brother around here. Something is weird.
Come in and sit with us. Sink.
I can't move. Why can't I move?
You're paralyzed.
Get out. Get out.
Get out. Rated R.
Which was a February release, which signals that, you know, I don't want to say it wasn't like with confidence, but it wasn't really like marketed as a prestige event. Right. And then what do you know? It became like one of the biggest movies of the year and became this huge phenomenon. And, you know, this is not always guaranteed when a movie becomes a phenomenon is also just like an excellent movie with a drum tight screenplay and several remarkable performances that launched a new name brand filmmaker, which never happens anymore. So that was part of why I picked this.
You know, my wife watched that Key and Peele show on repeat. I mean, like every episode 25 times. And when I heard he was making a movie, I was like, this is going to be some like white girl shit. This is going to be terrible. Oh my God, I couldn't have been more wrong.
This is important to note, even in the sort of it wasn't that long ago. 2017 was not that long ago, but he has become such a, I mean, it didn't just launch a filmmaker. It launched like a subgenre of horror. What he called at the time, the social thriller, like, you know, this idea of a horror movie that was sort of deeply in tune with what was happening socially and politically. But, you know, it's easy to forget that when we all heard about this, that he was going to make movies, we just assumed he was going to make comedies. And when we heard the premise of this, like, it wasn't marketed as initially announced as a horror movie. We all thought it was going to be like, you know, a broadly comic riff on Guess Who's Coming to Dinner. Like, it's a premise with comic possibilities. And then it turned out he was making something very different. And the reason I say what I said about the release date is that it really did feel stumbling out of this movie theater in a daze after the first press screening in February, like we really had just seen the first movie of the Trump administration. Like so much of what was in, none of this is, you know, movies take longer to make than that, but it just felt so much of what was in the air felt like it had made its way onto the screen.
Yeah, I mean, do you guys remember Keanu?
Barely.
Yeah, so that was the first Key and Peele run at the box office. It was not successful. Keanu was the name of the cat they have to rescue. And Then Jordan Peele decided that he wanted to go off and write and direct his own movie that was produced by Blumhouse, which famously has this formula of we do horror and we do lower budget horror that doesn't necessarily have established stars, so we can then guarantee at least a modest return. And then sometimes you have right. something like this that hits many, 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 Huge. Many multiples of its production budget. But, you know, it's one of those things where Jordan Peele just immediately proved... You know, you can see in his later movies, he gets the budget to do more like visual sophistication. Sure. And it's been amazing to watch him grow as a filmmaker. But right from the beginning, he has this ability to come up with these incredibly sticky concepts and visuals that just break out and take over the culture, like the concept of the sunken place. And it's just such an incredible metaphor that also just completely works in its own as a story. And I like... Again, it's so rare to see someone have such a strong debut that they then get, you know, not to reference another podcast, but the proverbial blank check that, you know, right. everything that he does from now on will be yeah. marketed as a Jordan Peele film, and justifiably so. And he also has his production company, Monkey Paw, that... As you said, he launched a whole subgenre, but also there are a bunch of very literal Jordan Peele productions that take after very legible aspects of his style, which is amazing that he was able to do that after like a singular movie and has only developed the concept of what that style is from here.
Yeah, and it's so exciting and frankly rare to see a first-time feature filmmaker come out of the box so confident. I mean, like, I just put it on tonight while I was sort of getting ready just as background. And first of all, don't fucking try that because this movie isn't background. But like, it is astonishing how fully formed he is as a filmmaker, how visually, thematically, but just his mastery of tone is astonishing. The things that he's doing in that opening sequence with Lakeith, out on that street in the suburbs is just like I've rarely felt such immediate dread in a motion picture as you do in that opening sequence. And the way that he's playing off of also, like, you know, what was sort of happening in Florida not long before that, and the baggage that is bringing on any moviegoer who's seeing a Jordan Peele movie. I don't know. And reams have been written, but it's such a perfectly realized debut film. It's really kind of astonishing.
Well, he famously considered a much darker ending. And I think so. Mm-hmm. The key to its success is that it lets you get right up to the edge of understanding exactly where this could go. And then delivering the movie magic, last minute save, catharsis. And I think maybe something I also want to shout out is just the central performances. Daniel Kaluuya wasn't exactly unknown before this, but this certainly catapulted him into a new stratosphere. Everyone who is charged with playing, you know, I guess I don't need to worry about spoiling a 7-year-old movie, but, you know, basically playing two characters at once. So Lakeith Stanfield, Betty Gabriel. Betty Gabriel just saying the word no over and over again is such an indelible image. And then... you know, perhaps this should not be the performance that does get spotlit considering her character's role in the movie, but Allison Williams has discovered such an incredible career. This was her first film role, and her character on Girls is obviously a supervillain for the ages, but is written as sort of a comedic protagonist who is just happens to be very hateable. And this was the first time she really leaned into that and was like, I'm going to be kind of a scream queen, kind of a villain, you know, in the same way that like Kirsten Dunst turns into such an amazing performance in, oh my God, something figures, Hidden Figures, you know, I have a lot of respect for white performers who are able to step into this kind of movie and just fully play like the worst possible person they could be. Catherine Keener and Bradley Whitford also do this. But Allison Williams now, like, really early locked into this archetype that she's now played, you know, most recently in Megan. Like, her character in Megan is kind of awful. And it's so smart for someone like her, who obviously enjoys many advantages to do. And, yeah, again, this Daniel Kaluuya performance, he's so good at, you know, carrying the audience surrogacy on his shoulders, playing terror in a way that, you know, the final girl is sort of the traditional horror protagonist who has to handle all that. And he is such a great final boy in this. And just, it's just watching him immobile, understanding what's happening to him, and just acting with like the smallest bits of tremors in his eyes is just like spectacular to watch.
Yeah, it's a great performance, and it's a great movie. All right, so moving on through the calendar, Allison, what is the next film chronologically for 2017?
My next film is Good Time.
Next?
You're incredible, do you understand?
Yeah.
No, I'm serious. You think I could have done that without you standing next to me being strong? Are you feeling this? Are you feeling the place I'm feeling right now?
Yeah, I'm cold.
You cold?
Yeah.
Let's get to Virginia, man.
Just keep your head now.
Turn around.
He's all right. We didn't throw
it. Whoa, whoa, whoa. Get back here. You're under arrest.
Which will turn out to be the penultimate film of the Safdie brothers as a united filmmaking unit. So pour one out for them. They've gone out on a high note. But of the two, sort of, we now have the clout to attract movie stars while also doing our extremely, you know, by the skin of our teeth, New York budget filmmaking. I do prefer Good Time to Uncut Gems a little bit. One of our mutual favorite movies is After Hours. And this is such a wonderful, like, spiritual successor to that as, like, a descent through the New York City underworld, except in this case, Robert Pattinson is Satan. He's in Virgil. And I think, you know, obviously Daniel LePatin's score, the sense of tension, the use of non-professional actors for the most part, all these things that the Safdies are famous for. But one of the things I love about this movie is that so Robert Pattinson's character, the trailer is sold to you like he's going to spend the movie trying to, in his eyes, protect and really endanger his mentally disabled younger brother, played by Benny Safdie, who I think is very convincingly said, like, listen, I understand the, like, optics of me playing someone with a mental disability, but on our filmmaking schedule, it would not be fair or right to subject someone with that actual condition to that. But there is a moment when you realize that Robert Pattinson's character has broken a patient out of a hospital who he thinks is his brother, and then realizes in an incredible moment of comedy is not. And I think all comedy is on some level of release of tension, but I just felt, I still can physically feel in my body, like, my anxiety just releasing, because there's this moment where you suddenly realize, like, he's not actually endangering anyone but himself as he spirals, and there's no point to it, which of course makes it funnier, but also you don't have that thing gnawing at the back of your mind of, like, what's going to happen to Benny Safdie, because what happens to him is that he just, you know, is attended to by our threadbare social safety net, which is not a happy ending, but is happier than being in the care of this sociopath. And it allows you to just, like, fully give yourself over to this roller coaster ride and follow Robert Pattinson as he descends deeper and deeper into his completely pointless and self-inflicted sense of panic. And I love it so much. I love Robert Pattinson's post-Twilight career.
Oh, my God.
This year alone, he's also in Lost City of Z, which is just, like, another amazing, I can't believe he's doing this moment.
How much of the great independent cinema of the past 7 years do we have to must we thank Twilight for? Like, must we thank the fact that, like, those two leads, him and Kristen Stewart, got enough clout to make whatever weird fucking movies they wanted for the rest of their careers, and have used that clout to get those movies made? It's a beautiful thing. This, I think, is my favorite Robert Pattinson performance, primarily for his absolute disregard for conventional notions of, you know, sympathy, empathy, for needing to have, you know, to have anything remotely approaching likability. It's pretty ballsy to do.
Can I just say, you know what the unsung hero of the Safdie brothers movies is?
Tell us.
their appreciation for the absolute scumbag nature of the goatee.
Yes.
I think that it's underappreciated how powerful they understand the, like, but it's not just like, it's not like a clean goatee. It's a goatee that's then grown in a little bit.
Yes.
And like,
it should have been shaved down a few days ago. Yeah.
With the scumbag nature of the goatee, they are the film's most powerful representers.
Yeah, it is
the poet laureates of the goatee.
It is a testament to the acting, the grooming, and the costume design that I don't find Robert Pattinson attractive in this movie, which is really an accomplishment. And I think also
the work
really on a lot of people's parts, and also the fact that, you know, Robert Pattinson is English and the Safdies are so of New York, they source so many of their recurring supporting players from the city, and you don't ever get the sense that this guy is just cosplaying this like Queens dirt bag. You totally believe he's of that world, and it's really like an amazing accomplishment.
Yeah, it's a terrific picture. Okay, so then moving on into the fall, Allison, what is the third film on your top five for 2017?
I selected Call Me By Your Name.
I can show you around.
That'd be great. Thank you.
Alicia!
Oh, to see without my eyes.
Is there anything you don't know?
First time that you
came. If you only knew how little I know about the things that matter.
Are you saying what I think you're saying?
Blessed be the mystery.
Call Me By Your Name, rated R.
Directed by Luca Guadagnino and starring He Who Must Not Be Named and Timothée Chalamet. And I mean, we talked about like witnessing the launch of a writer-director auteur in Get Out. And I think Call Me By Your Name is a logical follow-up to that, and that you get to witness the birth of a honest-to-God, true blue, capital M movie star.
Right.
Which is incredibly rare. And now Timothée Chalamet is one of like four people under 30 who can be called that, and they're all in Dune 2.
Right.
But
yes.
Yeah, this movie is obviously a queer coming of age romance set in Italy in the 1980s. And, you know, I love it because it's a queer coming of age story that's not centered on trauma, but also includes heartbreak. But it's the kind of heartbreak that's like,
happens to people.
This is just what it is to be alive. Yeah. And there's no particular like coming out of the closet moment. There's no, you know, gay bashing or anything like that. It's just a sort of tragic, but in a quotidian way, love story that has some great Sufjan Stevens songs in it. But, you know, there's just the feeling of like immersing yourself in this beautiful Italian countryside in the summer. The support, I mean, Michael Stuhlbarg is the dad, one of the best Jewish dad performances, matched only by Benny Safdie in Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret. Just, I have such fond memories of this movie and it really taking over the discourse, both, you know, there was the peach everything like that, but just being like, oh yeah, this kid is gonna go places, and he did. It's again, it's just an incredibly rare like lightning in a bottle moment that I feel very lucky to have witnessed in real time.
Yeah, no, the thing about Luca's movies too is that, you know, this one came after and I think the first of his films that I saw, I'm looking at the filmography now, yeah, the first of his movies that I saw came out 2 years before, which was A Bigger Splash. And after seeing that and then this, I'm like, okay, I just like every movie this guy makes, I just want to like Purple Rose of Cairo style, like walk into the movie and just like hang out, because he so beautifully creates a time and a place and just a sort of a sun-kissed beauty. Like you just want to like live in these movies. So that was a really, you know, really wonderful to take in. But the other thing that I think is sort of terrific about this one is the way that it is a kind of like passing of the torch in terms of generationally in terms of indie filmmakers, because, you know, the screenplay is by James Ivory, who we associate with, you know, sort of the art house movie of the 80s and early 90s, the quote-unquote Merchant Ivory movies, which I think are too often sort of pigeonholed as these sort of like buttoned up, staid, very British things, when in fact there are, you know, this is sort of the logical end point for some of the things that, you know, that they're doing in something like The Remains of the Day, that there always was passion burning in those movies. It's just, you know, by this movie, it's allowed to be to bubble up a bit more literally and metaphorically. It's a really beautiful movie.
You've seen I Am Love, right? The Tilda Swinton just swanning around Milan.
To this day, I haven't seen I Am Love, and I need to. I know that I need to.
That is a great predecessor of Luca Guadagnino, okay, really knowing how to shoot Italy. But yeah, again, the romance of it is so powerful. Like, another thing that you just don't see in movies often very much anymore is the like physical chemistry between these two people and the carnality of it that doesn't feel leering. It doesn't feel exploitative.
Right.
It feels totally essential to the story they're telling, but also, you know, isn't the like cliched, like blue tinted or like close ups of like three body parts that could be armpits or could be something else. You know, it yeah. really conveys how these characters' relationship is changing over time, and really also just the fact that it came out in the winter and it's such a warm weather movie. It's mm-hmm. like you could leave the theater and feel like you were 5 to 10 degrees warmer just having spent an hour or two in that moment.
Yeah.
Also inspired, I have to shout out one of the great sideways homages in, there's an episode of The Other Two where Drew Tarver's character ends an episode like looking tear stricken into the camera, and then they like start playing the Sufjan song and play like their version of the Call Me By Your Name credits, and just it just speaks to like the speed with which this movie became something that was like a common language among a certain sector of people. Was again like a reason I picked this year is that I have so many like active movie going memories. It's not just like I went back and discovered things after the fact, and it really mm-hmm. shows how those things can really like imprint on you and fuse with your brain cells that much more because you had this like very powerful experience.
Yeah that is I think a great way to end a movie that not enough filmmakers have taken advantage of. I think also, again, to shout out Roxana's episode, the ending of Michael Clayton is one of my favorite endings because they just run the credits while you hold on him, while you spend just a little bit more time with him quietly. It's such a powerful way to connect with your protagonist. Okay, it is time to hit the holiday season. And Allison, what is the fourth movie on your 2017 top five?
The universally beloved and not at all controversial Star Wars: The Last Jedi, written and directed by Rian Johnson.
Let's finish this.
We are the spark that'll light the fire that'll burn the First Order down.
In 8 days,
come on!
The epic saga continues.
Fulfill your destiny.
Rated PG-13. Get tickets now.
You mentioned, obviously, I write about TV, and one of the insane things that happened with this movie that would never, ever, ever be allowed in television is that apparently Kathleen Kennedy and the powers that be at Lucasfilm just handed Rian Johnson the ending of The Force Awakens and were like, you can take this in whatever direction you want. We're not going to dictate to you any like big story points that we may have planned for in this, you know, one of the most high stakes franchises of all time. But it meant that he apparently like legitimately got the freedom to elaborate on these characters. And the thing that will always stand out for me about this movie is the relationship between Daisy Ridley's Rey and Adam Driver's Kylo Ren, which is just the stuff of, first of all, the fact that that is every bit the equal of Leia and Han Solo as a, you know, indelible bit of chemistry. And then the fact that it is so rare to see like psychosexually naughty relationships of that specificity and complexity in blockbuster filmmaking in general, but in what is literally a children's movie. And the way that Rian Johnson steps into this canon and starts kind of futzing with it here and there. But, you know, the idea of like force timing, which just is a bit of filmmaking, like the way he handles those alternating shots between Ridley and Driver and communicates without any snazzy special effects that they are communicating with each other as if they're in the same room, even though they're on literally different planets, is just amazing. It's not like technical wizardry. It's not like a battle scene, although there are great battle scenes in that movie. But those are the scenes that always stick with me. And I just cannot believe that that was, you know, this air was allowed into this otherwise tightly stage managed genre. And he was allowed to do something interesting. That was, of course, rapidly reversed and squashed. And we don't need to speak of the film afterward. But, you know, like, think of what you felt in that last scene with the kid bringing up the sword and the message that sends of, like, this franchise could be about anything. It could be about anyone. There's limitless potential. That potential has been proved by what you just saw. It delivers on the emotional attachments you have to those characters while also taking things in unexpected directions. I just cannot believe that that was allowed to happen. I wish that we could allow more things to happen. And of course, Rian Johnson has gone on to do great things and the Star Wars franchise has not. So let that be a lesson to us all.
See, a lesson.
The way you describe it is fascinating. I didn't watch this one. I don't have any nostalgia for the Star Wars. They're fine. And I'm exactly the guy, the age, the everything that is supposed to buy all the shit and just sort of don't really care. But watch this movie for the first time today. It's on the list. I know we're going to talk. It's supposed to be a good one. I like all of his other movies, right? Might as well. I was amazed by the way he just recreated one of those first three movies from when I was a kid. How, like, all of these plot points, these relationships, these characters, so many things are exactly the same. And I was equally amazed that it fucking worked on me again.
Right.
I mean, it's like, how is it that sort of that I'm not, how is it that I'm not sort of bored with this movie because I've been watching it for my whole life? But it's because he knows how to use all the tricks.
He does know it. Yes, that's what I was going to say. Like, he's certainly not, you know, he's deviating from formula while also sticking to certain ideas that are common knowledge for
that
this
are
franchise.
Proven to work.
But there, the little stylistic flourishes that he, that again, he's been given the freedom to indulge in, that to make it look and feel different from those movies in these very specific and memorable moments. And the two visual things that I always think of about this movie, first of all, is, you know, the big sword fight, lightsaber fight in the Red Room. Like, that is like, when you say that title, that's the frame that pops into my brain. And the moment when that battle starts, like, the feeling of wanting to leap out of my seat the first time I saw this movie, like to jump out of my seat and cheer in the theater, which I haven't felt about one of these movies since I was 8 years old. And then also the thing with the white sand, like, who thinks of that? You know, that's like when you give a filmmaker, you know, some room on the leash, they're going to come up with cool shit like that. But I walked out of that screening, Allison, like, we've talked on the show before about how bad I am about predicting, like, fucking anything, you know, commercial success, audience appreciation, whatever. I walked out of that theater going, this is going to be the most successful movie of all time because it's a Star Wars movie and it's great and it's distinctive and it's funny and it's interesting and it's got all these great performances and yada, yada, yada. And, you know, as we will discuss later, it made more than enough money and most critics loved it. But boy, they're sure was a certain segment of the audience that did not care for it.
I mean, that thing that you mentioned earlier, sticking to the formula while also innovating on it, is like the Rian Johnson MO. Like, he comes out of the gate doing that with the detective noir, with Brick. He does it with, you know, the bottle episode and Breaking Bad. He now does it with the procedural and Poker Face and the Agatha Christie style whodunit in Knives Out, and he is just like our greatest practitioner of like artful genre maintenance. Like, he so clearly loves this, and he so clearly does not want to keep it in glass,
right,
preserved in amber. He wants to actually take it out and play with it and do interesting things. And I think he succeeds on both levels and is maybe our best. I feel like this would be perceived as an insult in some circles, but he's like our best middle brow stylist. Like, he knows how to hit a big audience and please everyone. Like, I took my mom to see Glass Onion in the theater and she loved it. And I can do that. I can go with a friend. I can go with a kid. And like a true, that is like the true potential of this level of movie, that it can be a totally all-encompassing cultural experience. And sometimes that can feel depressing when it's the 14th Marvel movie in 2 years. And sometimes it can be just a totally exciting thing that you need something at the scale of Star Wars to accomplish.
Beautifully said. Okay, well, that brings us to movie number 5, to the very end of the year. What was your what's your final film on your top 5 for 2017, Alison Herman?
Yes, my Christmas Day release, definitely the best New Year's Eve movie of all time. Phantom Thread by one Paul Thomas Anderson.
I never really liked myself, but in this work I become perfect.
I feel as if I've been looking for you for a very long time.
You found me. Reynolds has made my dreams come true. I am his, and his alone. And I have given him what he desires most in return. Every piece of me.
Phantom Thread.
His only movie outside of California, I believe. Or certainly outside of America. Because Heart 8 has, But just the fact that he left, he goes from Inherent Vice, this like sprawling epic of all things Southland that actually manages to sum up the complicated history of Los Angeles in the 60s, to a cloistered chamber drama with basically three roles of any significance in London. I picked this movie because I actually did not like click with it the first two times I watched it in a theater.
Oh, wow.
Okay. You know, just because like the relationship is so specific. Singular. Yes.
Yeah.
And if you cannot fully dial in to what they are feeling and how that evolves. Well, first of all, like the first time you watch Phantom Thread is basically just like a throwaway, because if you don't know how it ends, you do not understand what that movie is supposed to be. You think it's a drama. Right. Like, I remember the first two times I watched it, it was mostly with people who were seeing it for the first time. And it was almost like an even murmur of laughter steadily the whole time. We're like different people were laughing at different things. It was never super loud, because no, you don't know how you're supposed to react, because you're like, am I watching a murder suicide in progress? Like, where is this going?
Right.
And then when you understand what it is, which is a comedy in the Shakespearean sense where things work out for everyone in the end, and a comedy in the more modern sense where it has lots of incredible jokes, then that just shifts the way you perceive it, and you can go back and understand like the contours of their relationship and how it is evolving. And I just love that it is a movie that is challenging enough that you might need to take multiple runs at it to fully understand what it is doing, but also that Paul Thomas Anderson is someone who deserves the benefit of the doubt enough where I was like, okay, like that didn't work for me, but I want to try again. Like I want to at least see what other people are seeing. And of course it's so pleasurable to watch just in the,
right,
you know, you could watch it with your eyes closed and just soak in the score, and then you could watch it with the sound off and look at the dresses, and both would be entirely satisfying cinematic experiences in their own right. But instead, it all comes together. And again, Birth of a Movie Star has not quite panned out in the same way as Chalamet, but like Vicky Creeps going toe-to-toe with Daniel Day-Lewis is extraordinary. I can't believe that, you know, that's his final performance, and it's arguably like not the centerpiece of the movie. I mean, it is in some ways, but you know, she absolutely is his equal, and you need that for the concept of the movie to work, because you need to believe that even though these characters are an objectively unequal material footing, emotionally, she really does have his number and really does understand what he needs in the subconscious way that he will never be able to articulate, and is the reason why she differentiates herself from past partners and becomes more than a muse, becomes a true partner. And I just love this movie. I will rewatch it probably at least once a year as long as I am alive.
I see. I love that this is your experience with this movie, because mine is almost the exact opposite. I've only seen it once. And I am a rewatcher. Like, I rewatch movies I love all the time. I rewatch Paul Thomas Anderson movies all the time. His first three are among my most rewatched movies. When I saw this, it was about a month before it came out. It was a very early press screening. I knew like next to nothing about it. I'd either avoided the trailers, or the trailers were very enigmatic about what was so the and I had such a perfect experience watching it, not knowing where it was going, being surprised by it, being shocked by it in places, being in awe of where it landed, that I almost felt like I didn't want to puncture that perfect experience by revisiting it. I would like to, and I will one day, but I haven't wanted to risk that yet. So it's really interesting that we had such polar opposite in terms of watching and rewatching. That's really fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, it's completely different to rewatch that movie as opposed to watching it the first time, but it is almost like as good as, or even a better experience, because, so as I mentioned, the first few times I was watching it within the first few weeks of release, people had not seen it yet, people didn't understand. And then the third time, I went to go see it with a live orchestra accompaniment at the theater at the Ace Hotel. It was wonderful, but it meant that, you know, this was a few months in, this was like in the middle of Oscar season, so everyone in the room had seen it. And when you watch that movie in a big crowd where everyone knows what's coming and what the point of certain lines are, that just, it plays like a Judd Apatow movie. Like, everyone is just bursting into laughter, you know, when she's buttering her toast and the sound design makes it sound like she's like scraping a chalkboard, and when he just like looks at her funny, and when she like raises the water jug so it displaces the lamp a little bit in that final scene. And, you know, obviously a little bit of the sort of dread that accompanies the first watch that makes it feel like truly like a Rebecca style gothic movie is dissipated. But just the joy of watching these two weirdos slowly come to understand that like they are two pieces of an incomplete whole is, you know, again, it's delightful. And it means that it is a movie that, like, unlike, I just saw The Master again on a big screen, and that movie is wonderful, but that's heavy. Like, that was my second time seeing it ever. And I was like, I can go another 12 years before I do that again. Like, that will just sort of sit with me. And because, you know, this movie has that perfect little beautiful ending, I think it makes it something that you can return to as a holiday classic. It was one of the first movies that I showed my current partner when we first started dating, because I was like, you're going to need to, like, if you understand this,
buckle up, buddy.
We will understand each other. And, you know, we're still together. So I didn't throw things off the bat. You know, I didn't throw things off the rails immediately. But it is a good litmus test to those of you who may be in early stages of a relationship now.
Well done, Allison. I get it. You've talked me into it. You have talked me
into it. It's the fanciest movie about shitting anybody's ever made. I mean, it's the fanciest diarrhea joke. It's got to be the most expensive diarrhea joke in history.
Yes.
One of the great food movies, and it even addresses the thing that all food must become in the end.
All right, Allison, thank you so much for that resplendent top five. All ace choices across the board. Now let's find out about the big doings of the entertainment business in the year 2017. Here is Mike with the Hollywood Minute. Hollywood
freaks from the Hollywood scene. 2017 was one of the most predictable ass award seasons in recent memory, with pretty much every Oscar winner sweeping the predicating awards beforehand. Shape of Water's Guillermo del Toro for Best Director, Darkest Hour's Gary Oldman for Best Actor, I, Tonya's Allison Janney for Best Supporting Actress, and Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri's Frances McDormand and Sam Rockwell for Best Actress and Best Supporting Actor, respectively. The movie was not as good as people said it was. The only real toss-up was between Billboards and Shape of Water for Best Picture, as they'd split the run-ups, but The Fish That Fucks pulled out the win on that one.
Where do you land on those two pictures, Allison?
I am a Shape of Water defender. I greatly enjoy the cinematic stylings of Guillermo del Toro. That movie does include fish fucking, but it is not just a fish fucking movie. It is a very sad and gorgeous fairy tale. Three Billboards, I gotta say, I didn't mind when I first watched it. And then it's one of those things where I read every single pan and takedown and was like, I cannot disagree with any of this. I think everyone is making good points and has persuaded me, which, you know, sometimes that happens. And then sometimes I read pans of movies I love or like, and I'm like, this does not, this is putting me in the other direction. I am more staunch in my support than ever. So I think in that case, I was like, I understand where the backlash is coming from, and
I remain a Three Billboards defender, but it has gotten to be a lonelier and lonelier island with every passing year.
I was relieved when Martin McDonagh went back to Ireland, although I understand some Irish people have problems with the Banshees of Inisherin and its politics.
I'm an Irishman. Fuck them. It's fine.
Allison's Favorites did very well in the screenplay categories, with Jordan Peele taking the Oscar for Best Original Screenplay for Get Out, and James Ivory for his adaptation of Call Me By Your Name, both richly deserved. At the box office, however, we were still very much in the thick of superhero madness, and fully half, fuck me, we get what we deserve, half of the domestic top 10 was comprised of Underoo movies. The rest of the top 10 was similarly uninspiring, including The Fate of the Furious, Despicable Me 3, and Disney's terrible Beauty and the Beast live-action remake. But hey, at the top of the heap, there was still Star Wars The Last Jedi. So there were some people saw it. Who got to complain about it? Suck it, incels. Our motto. The biggest entertainment news story of the year by far was the fall of Harvey Weinstein, head of the first Miramax Pictures, and then the Weinstein Company, who, in addition to being a known bully and anti-art vulgarian, was revealed to be a serial rapist and sexual harasser via twin bombshell investigations published that fall by the New York Times and the New Yorker.
Mm-hmm.
Surprised Trump didn't pardon him. Fuck that guy, am I right?
Fuck that guy. He raised too much money for Democrats. That's the only reason Trump didn't pardon him.
I was about to say, known Hillary Clinton supporter, so take from that what you will.
There you go. There you go.
Yeah, well, she can go in there and hang out with him as far as... Anyway, this is a movie show. In addition to Harvey Weinstein's career, in 2017, we said goodbye to Exorcist creator and Exorcist 3 director William Peter Blatty.
Yep.
TCM's beloved Robert Osborne. The one and only Bill Paxton.
Bill Paxton. He was very young. He was too fucking young.
Don Rickles, that magnificent hockey puck.
Mm-hmm.
That's about as nice. That's way too nice of a thing to call him after the way he ran his mouth. Frequent Scorsese and Fassbender cinematographer Michael Ballhouse. Gun crazy femme fatale Peggy Cummins.
Yep.
Chappelle Show co-star and Eddie's brother Charlie Murphy.
Mm-hmm.
Damn. 80s kids James Bond, Roger Moore. Mm-hmm. MVP character actors Harry Dean Stanton, Michael Parks, Glenn Headley, Bernie Casey, Powers Booth, Robert Guillaume, and Frank Vincent. God damn, go home and get your shine box.
Yep.
As well as both John Hurt and John Hurd.
Yep.
That's a classic Bailey pairing there.
That is. It's weird that they had very similar names. They were both very good character actors. It's weird that they died the same year. That's all I'm saying.
John G. Avildsen, director of Rocky, Joe, and Save the Tiger. Very nice.
Yep.
Animal House co-star Stephen First, Oscar winner Martin Landau, GOAT playwright, screenwriter, and actor Sam Shepard.
Mm-hmm.
Seems surprising that he lived that long while we're talking about...
Mm.
Expectations. French New Wave icon Jean Moreau, the OG Nutty Professor Jerry Lewis, and three of our very favorite directors, Toby Hooper, George A. Romero, and Jonathan Demme. RIP to one and all.
We lost...
Damn, 2017 was harsh, bro.
Lost a lot of good directors that year. All right, thank you so much, Mike. Allison, you ready to do a lightning round?
Sure.
All right, I think you're going to do well with your the afternoons at the ArcLight. I think you're going to crush it. You know how it goes. I'm going to throw you out a list of other titles, movies we have not discussed from 2017. Say something brief if you'd like, pass if you'd like, and here we go. Blade Runner 2049.
I love colors. I love Denis Villeneuve. I love this movie. I know it has detractors. I feel emotions when I look at it and also experience the plot.
John Wick Chapter 2.
Amazing movie. I did the most cursed double feature of all time and saw this in I Am Not Your Negro at the ArcLight Hollywood. back to back.
And cinema can do a lot of things. Sofia Coppola's The Beguiled.
Underrated Sofia.
Yes.
One of the great movies, I think, about whiteness and white womanhood, and was undersold in its strength of insight. I think people just assume Sofia Coppola is like completely blind to anything except an Instagram filter. And I think that movie really shows she has like social perceptiveness as well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Also, one of the great recent movies about horniness. I'm going to say that as well.
Mm-hmm.
Christopher Nolan's Dunkirk.
My theory of Dunkirk is that it's a World War II movie for people who don't like World War II movies, and I am one of those people. I'm not like a Saving Private Ryan person, and I love this 90-minute movie with like 18 billion actors whose characters you will never be able to name.
The Lost City of Z.
The other great Robert Pattinson movie of this year. I love James Gray movies. This is also a 2.5-hour movie that feels like it's 90 minutes. It just sails by in a miasma of Amazon fumes.
Baby Driver.
Another movie I am a defender of. Another movie I saw at the ArcLight Dome. Good old-fashioned heist fun. John Hamm should play more villains and has lately.
Bong Joon-ho's Okja.
I love the pigs. I mm-hmm. love maybe not the first, but one of many truly unhinged Jake Gyllenhaal performances.
Yes.
We would get Morph a few years later, but like this guy walked so Morph could run.
My wife got up and walked out of that movie. We saw it in a theater. It ran for like 2 weeks. My wife got up and walked out with about 20 minutes left. And I was like, babe, I love you, but I will see you when it's over. I loved that movie so much.
It's
great. There's no way I was leaving.
It's great. That's great. Steven Soderbergh's Logan Lucky.
Adam Driver's accent in that movie is extraordinary. Riley Q is wonderful. I just love when Steven Soderbergh, like, I respect the iPhone experiments. I respect that he is committed to pushing the boundaries of cinema ever further out there. But sometimes when he just like wants to make a great heist movie full of yep. movie stars, he can still do yep. it better than anyone. And I selfishly kind of would like that more.
Mm-hmm. Greta Gerwig's Lady Bird.
I mean, speaking of birth of filmmaker auteurs, this movie may have hit too close to home as someone who like went grew up in California, went to college in New York, you know, precocious, etc. But I think that is a testament to how effective it is.
The Florida Project.
A movie I did not connect with as much as other people, but Willem Dafoe is incredible, and Brooklyn Prince is a wonderful discovery. So I appreciate this movie at the same time that I'm a little wary of it overall.
I, Tonya.
You know, 90s nostalgia and redemption of wronged women is a strong theme of this decade. I can't say I mm-hmm. think of I, Tonya as the best example of that, but it is maybe the most commercially successful and led a reevaluation. So I have to give it that.
The Lego Batman movie.
This one I never saw. I just saw the regular Lego movie. But we live in the culture that Lord and Miller created. Coco, oh my God. If I think of the first three chords of Remember Me, I will start bawling. So we should move on quickly.
Moving on. The Greatest Showman.
I sat that one out. I was like, nothing in this movie will give me as much joy as the memes. So good luck to you, Hugh Jackman.
Darren Aronofsky's Mother.
Now, speaking of movies, I will defend. I had an incredible in-theater experience. I got the one crowd that actually was eating that movie up. I'm not even a Darren Aronofsky person. I just love that movie. I love how chaotic and uncompromisingly batshit it is. And I think it did not get what it deserved.
Personal shopper.
Kristen Stewart staring at a phone does more than like every monologue that will be clipped in this year's Best Actress Oscar montage.
And finally, Steven Spielberg's The Post.
My friend saw it at the AMC Lincoln Square as like a Sunday matinee, and he said it was like watching the Avengers. Like, it was just a bunch of 65-year-old liberals just going absolutely insane. I respect the fact that that movie was made in 4 months more than I necessarily have like real thoughts and feelings about the movie.
And that concludes our lightning round. Allison, you did predictably magnificent. Where can people find you on social media and read your work?
I am at aherman2006 on the website formerly known as Twitter and Instagram and basically every social network. And you can read my regular work at Variety, usually on the website, sometimes in the magazine, always at variety.com.
I am Fun City Cinema on Instagram, Jason-Bailey on Blue Sky and Letterboxd, where you can find under my list the top fives for every damn episode of the show. Mike, where can people find you?
I am at BrainwashedLib on Twitter and at Fifth Column Films on Blue Sky.
And of course, once again, if you like the show, if you think other people might like it too, please bear in mind how fucking many movie podcasts there are out there. So if you could leave us a rating and or a review on your podcatcher of choice, that really would help us out. Mike, before we go, what is your favorite movie of 2017?
Well, I would not recommend you watch it back to back with John Wick 2, but I have got to shout out God tier director Raoul Peck at any opportunity and say, you know, I am not your Negro. He has a bunch of diary entries, basically journals of James Baldwin, that he takes and explores his relationship with different other black leaders. And it's just sort of the sort of just level of intellect, the brains that are working together, you know, between Baldwin and Peck, and then also the, you know, the other people that Baldwin is talking about and the sort of scenarios they're exploring. It's just a sort of entry into a conversation that, you know, most of us will never have conversations this good with people who are this important for our whole entire lives. And he sort of managed to make a movie out of it in a way that feels very personal. That is educational if you need it to be, that is not if you don't, you know. And this is the same guy who then went on to make what's his 4-part HBO series, Exterminate All the Brutes,
right?
You know, which is sort of his follow-up, and is just like so wildly different, you know. Anyway, I just love that guy. I love his movies. You know, I love Baldwin's books. And, you know, of course, there's always a little bit of nervousness of like, I am expecting this movie to blow my fucking mind. But I already kind of know everything happening. You know, I've already studied a lot of this stuff. I've read a lot of these books, you know, so on and so forth. But he manages it. You know, he manages to still like sort of give you everything that you hope for, but would never have the balls to expect. You know, so I'm Not Your Negro. Fantastic movie. How about you?
You know, when I did my year in list in 2017, because we're recent enough for that to have happened, you know, it was, I believe, a tie between I Am Not Your Negro and Mudbound, which I do highly recommend seeking out. A movie that sort of got lost in the shuffle because it was a Netflix acquisition, but is now part of the Criterion Collection and is really a gorgeous piece of work. But if I'm going by the letter of the law and your question is what was my favorite movie of 2017, the movie I have probably rewatched and enjoyed the most since then is probably Atomic Blonde. And I almost feel apologetic about it, but
fuck that. Great movie.
Atomic Blonde is like Charlize Theron as like a hot blonde bi combination of John Wick and James Bond. Like, it is one of the great action movies of the past several years. And there are two set pieces in that that I think are as good or better than anything in the Wick movies, which this was sort of made like in conjunction with, like, you know, the two guys who made the first John Wick, like one of them went off and made more John Wick movies and the other one made this and then a bunch of garbage. But they were kind of making them at the same time. And Keanu and Charlize were like training together. And all. Anyway, there's a sequence that is cut to Father Figure by George Michael. This was in 2017 when the ironic counterpoint music was not yet quite a cliche it has become, where she's just beating up a bunch of fucking people in an apartment using like household props, Jackie Chan style, which is just like my favorite shit in an action movie. And then there is a one of those, again, before this became a cliche, one of these like, you know, made to appear seamless, you know, 5-10 minute just her going through an entire apartment building just beating the shit out of people. And it's all so good, it's so thrilling, it's so sexy, it's so much fun. I feel bad that I'm always picking, like, you know, the junk food movie compared to your like highly intellectual documentary or whatever, but I'm doing it again this week and I don't give a shit. Allison, what were you going
to
say?
I was going to ask if you've rewatched it enough times that you understand the plot.
No. I mean, I've watched it, I mean, a dozen times probably. And no, I still don't understand the plot. Could not matter less. Like, if there were ever a movie in which you can sort of invoke the ghost of Hitchcock's MacGuffin, it's Atomic Blonde. Plot doesn't matter. It's all about style, and the style is magnificent.
Buddy, if you've only ever eaten cheeseburgers, you need to have some caviar. But if you've only ever eaten caviar, you need to have a fucking cheeseburger, dude. They're really good. I mean, you know, I think that's...
Thank you, buddy. Thank you so much. All right. Thank you again for doing this, Allison.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you, Mike.
Thank you, Jason.
And thank you for listening.
It was a very good year.